You're listening to episode 76 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? If you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other fellow writers, or if you'd like to submit questions for future guests on our show, join me over in our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. You'll also get sneak peeks of our publishing calendar for future episodes. For my craft-focused writers, there's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there. Now on to our show, we have Heidi Heilig with us today. Heidi is the author of the duology, The Girl from Everywhere, which was listed as a widely loved and recommended book to read by NPR. Her sequel, The Ship Beyond Time, just released this week and was listed as one of the 35 most anticipated young adult novels of the year by Entertainment Weekly. In today's episode, we discuss the importance of reading and promoting the work of various authors to encourage diversity, and how to respectfully write about communities outside of your own experience. Heidi shares the experience of her first heartbreak and how that inspired the themes of romance and time travel in The Girl from Everywhere. Further into our conversation, we also touch on mental health stigmas and what we can do to help break down the stereotypes. For our craft-focused listeners, Heidi shares advice on how to improve your craft, how to find inspiration for your characters, and how to tie multiple historical elements together in your story. We also unpack Heidi's experience with her editor and how an editor can bring out the best in your writing. Now let's jump right in. Hey everyone, we have the awesome Heidi Heilig with us on the show today. Heidi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I know The Ship Beyond Time is coming out March 28th.
Luckily, it was moved up. So February 28th is the new date.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thanks. I guess I got everything done on time, which surprised me.
Even more exciting, we get to have the book in our hands a month earlier. I love the cover reveal for The Ship Beyond Time, and I love the cover, The Girl from Everywhere. When I was picking up your book from Barnes & Noble, oh my gosh, it really stood out.
They did an amazing job with it. I think they'll look good on the shelves together too, the black and the white.
Yes, I do think so too. I noticed that contrast. I like it. Did you expect it to look like that at all? Did you have a say in what goes into the covers, or not at all? You left the trust with the designers.
I have no visual sense whatsoever. So it's a lucky thing that I didn't have much of a say. Originally, for the first cover, they gave me a set of 8 or 12 potential covers. They said, which do you love? Which do you really not like? And I said, okay, this one's my favorite. That one is my least favorite. And they said, okay, well, we're not going to go with either of those. So I didn't get my first pick, and luckily I also didn't get my least favorite pick. The second book had my first choice.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Did you watch Moana?
I haven't yet. I wanted to see it, and then I saw that there were some questions about it. Some people said it was great rep, and some people said it was a little iffy. So I've been a little bit on hold, for I really get out to see movies so rarely. It's something that I've been considering seeing, but I've heard a lot of people say it's wonderful.
I personally loved it, and I walked away with the biggest smile on my face, trying to belt along to the main theme song awfully. I actually watched it with a really dear close friend of mine. She's Samoan, and it really meant so much to her for us to watch it together on Thanksgiving or near Thanksgiving, right when it came out. For her personally, it was finally some sort of representation of her and her family. She's so proud that her nieces can grow up with a movie like this and recognize themselves in the characters there. I did hear mixed comments too about the representations. I've read articles from people saying that it was negative, but it was interesting hearing and watching it with my dear friend who very much related to it and felt it was mostly good for her.
Yeah, having just been in Hawaii, there were a lot of people there, obviously, that were really excited about it and very, very happy to see a local girl make good as the star. With anything, you're going to get mixed mixed reviews. And I think all of the Pacific people that worked on it as sensitivity consultants, they did good work and they were, I'm sure, proud of what they had put out. With any piece of art, there are going to be people who have a different take on it. And mm-hmm. all of those opinions have to be valid as long as they're coming from the people that are being shown. So the yeah. people who loved the rep because it showed them, great. And the people who hated it because it showed them in the way that they thought wasn't the best, they're right too. They're all right.
I actually brought this up because I watched Moana and the cover of The Ship Beyond Time, it was a bit reminiscent and reminded me in a positive way of Moana because one of the main characters, he has a hook and also has a lot to do with the ocean and the ships. The visuals, because that's what I walked away with from the movie, just gave me the good chills again when I saw your cover.
I'm so glad.
I thought that was such a random note, but I'm like, I'd love to share that with you. It's interesting because we're talking about how you mentioned every piece of art, there's going to be mixed reviews. We have this private Facebook group for the podcast, and there's one member that mentioned she wants to write for a certain group of people about them, but then she has no relation or tie to them at all. She was wondering, is it wrong of her to write those characters? For me, my take was more so, I think as long as you really are very respectful and you really do your research and you go around interviewing as many people as possible, getting an unbiased take of it, where they're coming from, no one can really fault you if you really go in doing all your research. For me, I would want more exposure for certain groups of people who aren't having as much exposure normally, as long as you go in with really good research, and also extremely important that you have good intentions to share their stories too. And I wanted to ask you, how do you answer that member if she asked you that at a conference?
What I would say is that I have a slightly different take on it than you do. I mean, not wildly. I think reasonable minds do differ. Obviously, going in with research and respect is the very most important thing. And no one can tell you what to write and what not to write because everyone is their own person. The first question I would ask myself is, why this story? Why are you the right person to tell this story? And again, you may have the perfect answer for this, and there may be a great reason. Of course, it's hard for me to say because I'm not all of the characters in my book. I am not Noor. I am not a Chinese monk. I am not any of these things. I am simply parts of a few of the characters. I write about people that are outside of my own experience, and I hope that I do it justice. But the first question I would just always ask myself, writing any story, is why am I the right person to tell this story? Is there a better person to tell the story, and am I taking their place? If I were to write a story that was completely not my own and take the spot of a more marginalized writer, would I be doing it justice? Is that me coming at the story with the greatest respect possible? I'm not sure. I can't give the right answer to that, but those are just all things to consider. Again, I don't ever want to turn a writer away from writing. I think that writing is so wonderful and following your dream is so important, but I also think that making sure that you are absolutely being the most respectful to people, basically not stepping on other people who already have enough to deal with.
I understand that point of view because that's actually where my grandpa comes from. He's an artist and we have a lot of these conversations over the phone when we're catching up and also over the dinner table, which is what I love. We do it very respectfully and I think it's important to hear each other out. For me, you know, he's an artist and I'm just like, okay, then what about art? What about creativity? What if these authors really have a story, even though they're not the people to represent the marginalized? Like being Caucasian and having their say so that they're not being bystanders, so that they're shining a positive light too and saying, hey, I am Caucasian myself and I'm supporting this group. This is why I'm writing this.
Totally. I think that's an interesting thing. You know, white writers don't want to leave out characters of color and just write an all white story or an all neuronormative or heteronormative story because these are all things that don't reflect the real world. And yeah. I think that if you write a whitewashed story or all one way, it starts to look pretty fake, honestly. Mm-hmm. The thing I would just say is one way to help is not always to write about something. Sometimes it's to read or to mm-hmm. promote. Obviously, depending on where people are in their writing journey, sometimes the best thing to do is to promote the work of others and mm-hmm. then also write inclusively. I'll give an example that would be super obvious to me. I have an agency sister. Her name is Angie Thomas. Everyone has probably heard of her. She is a Black writer and she is a debut. She's coming out out with her book, The Hate U Give. Actually, it's on the same day as The Ship Beyond Time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Her book is contemporary, and it's about the Black Lives Matter movement. It was a 13 publisher auction. There's a movie coming out, and Angie has written this amazing book as a Black writer, is the exact person to tell a story about Black Lives Matter. If I had tried to tell that story as a very well-meaning, with hopefully I can say the best intentions, I still think I just am not the person to tell such a powerful, specific story to Black people. If I was writing a main character that was more like me and there was a love interest who was Black or friend or any of these other characters that are not exactly the central character, or if you're writing a Black character and it's not all about their race or the fraught issues that they face, I think that's great because that's inclusive writing, but it's not appropriative. Again, not to tell anyone what to do. That's just completely where I'm coming from, not necessarily where everyone is coming from.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that. There's just so much happening, especially with Trump now.
Oh my gosh.
Social media has allowed us to see more of the truth. That's my take on it. I don't think social media has made it worse. There's some people that believe that. I say no. I think it's actually exposed more of what has been going on for a very, very long time.
I agree.
A lot of people that I bumped into did not believe me when I said that there's very much racism happening, and also in New York City, which is supposed to be like a melting pot and all that. And I'm from New York. I would go through that a lot almost every day when I would go to college or auditions and whatnot, and people just don't understand it. But now it's like, okay, you see, there's proof now. Back then, I didn't have a camera or I didn't have a cell phone that could take videos of what people were saying. What I admire about you especially is that you take action. You write letters that you can copy and paste on your Facebook.
Yes.
We can express how angry we are when we're talking to our family members or our closest friends. But how do we then communicate that to bring it outside to actually create change?
I try to give back. I try to create actions that other people can do and to make it easy. It took me a really long time to learn how to do that. And then I also realized sometimes people just don't have the energy, health, or anything, but still wants to participate. Sometimes it's just easiest to give them a few clicks to finish up a solid action that they can take to make the world a better place. It's really my honor to be able to do that. I hope it's helpful to people.
Oh, no, I think that's amazing. I love that. You're one of the few that stand out to me. You make it accessible and very doable for people who follow you to see, okay, I can create change rather than just saying and wishing good wishes.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that. I think that's really important to have leaders like you out there doing stuff like that. And that also inspires change.
I hope so. It's something that trickled down to me. I've learned it from other activists and people who have taught me. So it's certainly something that is good for their legacy, I guess, to honor their legacy to continue.
I do also want to tap into where you grew up and a little bit more about your background. I understand that you grew up in Hawaii.
Yes.
And your bio says that you rode horses and raised peacocks. What?
I did. I lived on a farm in the back of a valley north shore of Oahu, and we had so many animals. My mother had always loved animals, and we got a reputation for being the soft-hearted people. It got to the point where people would lower cat carriers over our fence to leave sick animals for us because we would take them to the vet and take care of them. I know, and we ended up with a lot of pets that way, a lot of strange and interesting pets.
You basically had a sanctuary.
Yeah, like weird Dr. Doolittle people. My mom, she is such a softie, and she would take all the animals to the vet. We ended up with a mongoose. It was found as a baby mongoose abandoned by its mother. Oh. And so someone put it in a cat carrier over our fence. And so we took it to the vet and raised it until it reached mongoose puberty. And then it started biting everyone. Then we found the right way to release it into the wild.
Wow. Oh my God, I hear him. He's so cute.
Oh yeah, that's the baby. Sorry. He's adorable. He's one of my little repatriated animals. He's furious. Totally skipped his nap, so he's mad.
So cute. You can tell him when he's older. Guess what? You're on a podcast when you're a baby.
Oh,
did you know that?
He would love that. He loves attention, but he's shy, but he loves making sly smiles at people, being the center of attention.
Oh my gosh. Cool. So you were in Hawaii until how old before you moved over to New York?
We moved when I was 17, and we left my high school right before senior year. And I thought my life was over because I was in love with my best friend. I had never told him. We had both had other boyfriends, girlfriends at the time. So we were never quite had the opportunity to say anything. And my mom wanted to move to New York so she could go back to school. And so she uprooted the family and brought us here. I left left everything behind and I was so sad. I had always regretted, oh, I'm never going to have true love or whatever. It was so dramatic. Years later, now this is the guy, obviously, that's the parent of my child. So we found each other again after all that. For a while, it was super dramatic. New York was like dank, bleak place of heartbreak and sadness. But that was what I was like when I was 17. So
how did you guys find each other again?
We're friends. That's why a lot of the themes in a lot of my writing for a long time was regret and time travel, going back to the past so you could fix something that you had always wanted to change. My first heartbreak was the basis of all of my bad and now hopefully better work. We found each other again. I was actually back there for a wedding and he was there and we reconnected. And so we're together again.
I love that. Congratulations. I know it's a bit late of a congrats, but it's very sweet still.
It's gross, but it's nice.
It is not gross at all. I'm a sucker for these kind of stories. Then you studied college in New York City.
I went to NYU for acting, which was the worst mistake. I'm very extroverted, but I'm really not good at in-person rejection. And I'm also just not built to be an actor. I mean, you've been on auditions and you know when you have a non-mainstream look, things get very difficult. But then I went on to do musical theater writing, which was great. It was also expensive. Luckily, my mom was working at NYU. So it was covered under that. But it took me a long time to figure out what I wanted to do. I had that luxury, I guess. I'm pretty spoiled. You know, when you have mom who will do this, do that, work, get you all these things, you don't necessarily have to push yourself so hard. So I came out of everything pretty spoiled. And it took me a very long time because I had the luxury of time to just go to school and go to school and go to school and figure it out.
Listen, if you're lucky enough to be provided that kind of luxury, then go with it.
Oh, yeah.
Then from there to writing a novel, they're different beasts. How did that transition happen?
I had been writing some shows, some songs with my collaborators. I don't write music, so I have collaborators that I work with to do the music, and they also help on book and stuff. Book meaning, for those who don't know, the play portion of a musical. I have an office job, so I was at my day job, and I was unable to get in touch with the collaborators. One was on tour, and one doesn't work necessarily as much over the internet. He likes to work in person. So I was like, well, on my low hours in my day job, why don't I just write a novel? I loved reading YA. I'm an avid and always have been an avid reader. And I just thought maybe I'll try it. And I wrote about 1,000 pages total, almost 600 of which never made it into the final version. It took a lot of figuring out and cutting and rewriting and massaging until I got it to be an actual novel instead of something that looked like it was written by someone who had only ever written theater before. So it took a lot of practice. But, you know, I had the time and I just wanted to try it out.
There's no teacher involved or person to push you to write a novel. That was just all you.
Yeah. I feel the impetus to write novels often comes from the person. I'm sure so many writers out there who are just like, I just know I need to write a novel. I think that you don't need, I have an MFA, but in musical theater writing, but you don't need an MFA to write a novel. You just need to read a lot and to have the will to practice and the time, obviously. That is a luxury to sit down and write things out.
What books were you reading around the time where you were inspired to write your novel?
It's funny. I was reading The Monstromologist by Rick Yancey at the time. The reason I love that book so much is the character that the series is named after, The Monstromologist, seems to me to be bipolar. And I am bipolar. And I read the book and I was like, this person seems like me. I had not seen that in a book before. I was so blown away by that and drawn to writing a bipolar character that I decided to write a book about with undiagnosed on the page, but obviously a very bipolar character that was like myself. Also, that's the father character.
I was going to say that's like Nix's dad.
At the time I was trying to get pregnant and that was very difficult for me unexpectedly. I realized I had endometriosis, which I hadn't known before. So it took me a very long time and I thought I would never have a kid. And I was like, well, maybe I'll just write one and I'll write how I would be a terrible parent because I have all these problems. And then, long story short, I was in the hospital for preterm labor when I got the call that the book was selling. It was quite a weird up and down journey.
Wow. Is that healing or what?
It was. Huh?
I love that you are very open. I have a lot of people in my life who do. Some of them are younger, more like mid-20s. Of course, the topic, the conversation of having children. I love children and I love families. I'm a big family person. That's how I grew up. One of my good friends, I feel like she'd be an amazing mom, and just the way she is with people and also animals too. I remember talking to her about having kids in the future, and she definitely doesn't want to because she's not sure what would happen. It's almost not being able to trust herself with a child. Did you always know you wanted kids, or do you not want kids and you changed your mind?
When I was younger, my mom is a great mom, but I was a surprise, and she had still maybe not done all the things that she had dreamed of doing when she had me. And she tells me, and I absolutely trust her on this, that she would never have anything any other way. Mm-hmm. While I know that kids are often can be amazing blessings or entities in people's lives, they can also sort of alter the course of your life. When I was younger, I wasn't sure that I wanted that. I think as a woman, most people have this career versus children to ponder. And then as I tackled my illness and learned what I was like as an adult, I got the impression that I would not be the most responsible parent, but I was trying anyway. I thought I could do it, thought I might as well try. And my husband is very stable. So I knew that despite my sort of ups and downs, that my husband was a stabilizing presence for myself. And I think would also be that for my child. Luckily, it's turned out fine so far. A lot of the things that create a perceived weakness when you have a health issue, you learn to compensate, you learn to work with it. Sometimes you learn to be stronger in certain ways that counteract those weaknesses. I figured it out enough to make it work. As far as I can tell, my child is very happy. He's only 2.5.
He sounds happy. He's just angry he doesn't have a nap. That's it.
Yeah, no, he is. And he's mad that I'm not accessible right now. I'm the fun parent. I'm favorite parent. I will make sure my husband does not listen.
Well, we'll have to bleep this out. For listeners who might be struggling with triggers and cycles, is there anything that you can share with them?
That's so hard. There's such a stigma around mental illness. And I mean, especially I know in Asian families, it being half Chinese, I know that whole side of my family also struggles with naming any illness, but mental illness is especially so shameful. I think that if you're worried about someone in your life and they're absolutely not interested in diagnosis or going to the doctor or any of those things, you can't really diagnose someone for them. All you can really do, I think, because I remember being super defensive about 10, 15 years ago when I was first starting to struggle with my diagnosis, I was very defensive. I didn't want anyone else talking about it. And I didn't want to be a topic of discussion at all. If I could even sense people thinking about it, I was very annoyed. And so I think that's a normal part of it. But I think the thing that really did help me was seeing other people I admired open up about it, seeing characters that were heroes. I mentioned that book, The Monstromologist, yes. And seeing a heroic, tragic character that was like me was really meaningful to me. And maybe helping expose them to media. I don't know if any of your family loves Star Wars, but knowing that Carrie Fisher was bipolar, and did this amazing work all through her life was so affirming to me and has been so affirming to so many other people that I know. That just showing them that people can be amazing heroes and be openly mentally ill, I think is a wonderful thing that could release them from some of the stigma.
Like we were saying, the Asian culture overall, it's so bad, their stigma, their thoughts around it. They think automatically any kind of mental illness is quote unquote labeled crazy and a very bad, bad thing. It just frustrates me so much. Even depression, which I've dealt with, and also once you have depression, it's the rest of your life. It's automatically labeled as crazy, especially the older generation. What about for listeners who might know or have an inkling that they might have a mental illness? Any words of advice about what they should do?
Sure. The gold standard for people that think they may themselves be suffering a mental illness would be, for me, go to the doctor to be able to talk it out, to be able to try different maybe medications or therapies that will help, and to pay attention to what help you feel better and what helps you long-term, what's sustainable. and then to abide by that program religiously. That is such a difficult standard, not only because mental health professionals are sometimes expensive, they're sometimes not covered under insurance if people even have insurance, and sometimes just really hard to do things the quote unquote right way. Sometimes it's just hard to take your medication or to even get out the door to see a doctor. I think that if you can do those gold standard things for you, I think that you will find something that works for you and that makes you feel better. I think if you can't, that's okay too. Whatever you can find that will help you feel better, you should cling to that and try to live that as religiously as possible. If exercise and eating right helps you, it helps me. Running really helped me, especially when I had to get off my medication to try to get pregnant. Running and having a set schedule really helped me. But I learned that by listening to my body and tracking my moods and doing all those things that really are time consuming and annoying. You can't always get the energy to do that or the desire, the will to do it. But if you can do anything that brings you towards figuring out how to consistently make yourself feel better, even if it's one thing, I think that that's wonderful. I think you should high five yourself, celebrate it, just keep working and working to try to live the best possible life that you can put together for yourself. And that's not going to be the same for everyone. Sometimes things are out of reach or too hard, and don't beat yourself up for that either.
Thank you for that. That was really powerful. I'd love to throw in listener questions, fans of yours who love you. Yeah, they requested for you on the show.
That's such an honor. You guys, that's really nice.
They love you. The first one I'd love to ask from Tara Turley Creel. She would love to know if growing up in Hawaii inspired Girl from Everywhere, or did your love of travel inspire you to write that book?
Oh, both. Tara, both. Okay, so growing up in Hawaii, I learned so much about how the land was stolen from the Native Hawaiians. My mother was really involved in politics there. I was exposed a lot to the dream of sovereignty and taking the land back. And so that was a big inspiration for the fact that at the end there are these, I don't want to give away too much, but the villains in the book are definitely sugar barons. And that is definitely taken from my upbringing there. But my love of travel definitely also plays into it. I would love to be able to look at a map and go there. Obviously, with a child, it's a little bit tougher, but that would be the dream, to take a ship and sail away to wherever I wanted to go.
I could totally imagine you and your family living on a boat and just traveling the world.
Ah, yeah, I could imagine that too. That would be amazing.
And you can homeschool your baby boy, and then till the time if he wants to go to college, then all right, we could drop him off at whatever port he wants to go. The research that you've done, you had the 1886, the fire in Chinatown was real.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
For you to dig up all those facts and the research, I'm assuming that you've always loved the theory or the concept of time travel.
I have. I love all those good old 80s and 90s time travel movies like Terminator and Back to the Future. Oh, yeah. And I also really got into it, like reading the physics of it, the wormhole theories and the billiard ball theory and all these things that are just really interesting and dorky. I didn't go the sci-fi route for the book, but I still love knowing about it.
I think that's really awesome. And by the way, it's not dorky. I think it's sexy and hot as hell that you know all of that stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I think that's so cool. Do you remember where your first love came from for time travel? Like, aside from the movies, was there anything else?
I remember loving H.G. Wells' Time Machine when I was really little. I feel like it's always been a fascination, not just for me, but for people in general. The idea that you could, you know, go back and see, I read Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court when I was really little. And I think it might have been my dad who started reading those books to us when he was still reading to us. I was very young when he first read me the Time Machine, and then I read it again later. So it's probably somewhat his fault.
That's an awesome blame to have, right?
Yeah.
So how is this research process like? You threw in facts from the 1886 fire in Chinatown and a whole lot of other facts too. How long was that process? So that same listener question from Tara, how are you able to keep track of all the pieces and make sure that it all fits? For her personally, she loves reading time travel books, but she's not sure if she's up for writing one. And I can totally understand where she's coming from, because it's a lot of work. I mean, unless you're really, really passionate about it, I think it would throw me for a loop. I would just feel so overwhelmed and very, very scattered.
Yeah.
Did you pick one specific scene that just couldn't get out of your head and just started from there and started to branch out and then fit the pieces together? Or did you have a system?
With both books, I started with a historical oddity that I really couldn't stop thinking about. And in book one, it was that newspaper article that was about piracy in 1884 in Hawaii and the theft of the gold from the Iolani Palace and the treasury, which might have been a fake article anyway. Saw people trying to research this article, people trying to figure out if this had really ever happened. I thought it seems a very mystical thing that someone could report something that may have actually never happened. And so it started me thinking about like alternate universes and timelines. And so I went from that article to the rest of the book. And with book two, the thing that struck me was the disappearance of a sailor named Donald Crowhurst. He was racing around the world in a yacht race in, I think, 1968 to 69. It was around the world single-handed yacht race. It was for a bunch of prize money and all this fame and fortune. And he set out from England and he claimed all these really fast times, and he was radioing back with this amazing journey. And then they found his yacht abandoned in the Sargasso Sea. He had jumped overboard and he had taken his logbook, and he had left a bunch of logbook behind showing that he had faked his entire journey, that all of this hullabaloo had gotten to him and driven him crazy. So his disappearance stuck with me, and I thought, what if he had instead stepped into a different timeline and learned how to time travel that way? It's these historical things that inspire me. From there, I like to pin together different historical gems and weave them together.
Man, that's amazing. Could you give us like a snapshot of how your working space is like, whether it's a room or a living room, wherever you work, wherever you create your magic? What is your wall looking like? Are there index cards everywhere lined up? I love these kind of visuals just to get into your world and see how you work that magic.
All of my writing is mostly contained inside my computer. On my computer, you'll see a million tabs open. It's all these little tiny fingernail tabs across the whole thing of all these different research windows and pictures of things that remind me of other things, old drafts and notes to myself in Google Docs, because I write in two different locations. One is my office. I hope my bosses aren't listening to this. It's a beautiful office. I'm a receptionist, so it's this marble palace.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sitting at this gorgeous desk. There's an orchid and everything. It's very clean. The coffee is great. And then at home, I have a live edge desk that my husband made, and the window, I can see the Empire State Building.
Wow.
In Brooklyn. It's a studio in Brooklyn, and it's a brick wall that we expose the brick ourselves.
Stop.
I know.
So dreamy. Girl, you are so Pinterest worthy with your designs in your room. Oh, I'm so jealous. That's so awesome.
I'm very lucky.
Oh my God. Yes. Continue. So expose brick. Red or did you paint it white?
It's red, and there's dark wood trims on the window and a bunch of string cafe patio lights around the window.
Oh my freaking goodness.
Yeah.
It's
nice.
Dream.
Well, it's also covered in like yogurt and whatever Cheerios that my baby has been eating. That's kind of dabbed artfully around the table.
I love it. I would probably turn my space into a co-working space instead, just so that all the creative people can come in and do their thing and just create.
That would be great.
We'll make sure to have the exposed brick as well. Oh my God. And the wood trimmings. You know why I'm like obsessing even more right now is because I was just on Pinterest. I have been visiting for the last 2.5-3 months, and my girlfriend and I wanted to surprise my baby sister because she's the one running around doing everything for the family after I've moved, and she just goes over and beyond. Whatever paycheck she gets from work, she spends money buying things to make life a little bit more comfortable. She'll buy this hot towel rack for my dad. Aww. Just so that when he gets out of the shower, he has a warm towel heated up by that metal rack that she bought.
That's
on Amazon.
So nice.
Like, she does things like that, and she'll hang up, you know, like the patio lights that you were talking about in your space. Mm-hmm. She bought that to hang up in my mom and dad's room because she knows how much my dad loves lights and he's stressed out at work, and that calms him down, like, or just gives him peace. She does little things like that. Just so kind. So we're like, what can we do in return? Because she does so much, not just for my parents, but for me and my middle sister and my girlfriend, whoever's in her life. She loves makeup, and she always does makeup on this laminated wooden desk. And then we just totally did a surprise makeover. So we can't wait for her to come home to see it.
Oh,
we painted
gosh.
It all white, and then my girlfriend unscrewed all the hardware, all the handles to the desk, and then we spray painted that metallic gold, then screwed it back in. So it's white, all white, and then the handles are gold. We went to IKEA and found this great deal, a $20 chair that was just plain white on top and metal on the bottom. We spray painted all the metal gold so it matches, and my little sister has this sheet rug for a seat. Mm-hmm. We plopped that on top of the seat, and oh my goodness, it looks so grand. And
that sounds amazing.
So excited. Heidi, I'd love to know what is exciting you most about your work right now. I know that you have part two of your duology, The Ship Beyond Time, coming out in February. So you have that you're gearing up for.
Gosh, it's funny because publishing moves so slowly that things have to be done months and months before they actually come out. I'm working on the next book already. This is just a duology, but I'm working on the book that will be my next book, the start of a new series. Right now, I have my first draft into the editor and she's going to get back to me with her notes soon. So that's what I'm most excited about. It's interesting. The main character is bipolar. And so I really was excited to write that. I don't want to give too much of it away, but it is definitely, there are people that are familiar to me from my life in it. And I just, it's a lot of fun to write. I mean, obviously I'm super psyched about book two coming out. It's going to be weird to say goodbye to these characters. Mm-hmm. So I'm putting that off a little bit in my brain.
You know what'd be cool? If you host a goodbye party.
Oh my gosh. That's interesting. I'll smash a bottle of champagne over the book.
Yes.
Launch it out and be like, farewell.
That would be awesome. You were matched up with your editor through your agent?
My agent sold the book to HarperCollins. She was setting up an auction and Green Willow at HarperCollins came in with a preempt. And I liked Green Willow. I had read books that my editor had edited previously and really loved them. I was very excited about that. And I said, yes.
You're so happy with them. You felt like it was almost like a soulmate?
Yeah. Like I said, I had read The Girl of Fire and Thorns series by Rae Carson. That was another book that had gone into my decision to write YA. I had read that book and thought it was really fascinating and an interesting take on fantasy. And then ta-da, I found out that my editor had worked on that book. And I was like, this is great. She seemed really nice. I didn't really know her very well at that point, but it seemed like a great situation. And it has proven true. She's a really wonderful person. I love working with her.
It's always so amazing to have great editors on your team where they can see the holes in your story and can bring that to your attention for you to improve it. What about times where you're just, oh, no, that just does not work?
You know, I'm really lucky. It's been very smooth. We had a difference of opinion on the ending of book two. I was feeling angsty. I was like, I should make this tragic. She's like, I don't think that's a good idea. I was like, no, you're right. Let me not make it as tragic because no one would ever forgive me. And she was like, yeah, I think I would never forgive you. And that was that. She curbs my worst impulses and brings out the best in my work. I'm the kind of person that works best with collaboration. I know that there are some people who work fantastically by themselves. They have fully formed ideas and they don't really want to bounce things off as much. For me, I really need that back and forth feedback from other people.
And when you mentioned the different way of ending the story, she mentioned, yes, it's tragic the way you wanted to end it, but a lot of people wouldn't forgive you for it. For you yourself as a writer, I'm approaching it more as like artistry. Were you happy for yourself, not for fans, not just for the readers, but you yourself as the artist? Would you have been just as fine or happy if you did end it the way you wanted to originally?
I fully respect and get artistic integrity. I don't know if it's just for me. I can see a million different ways to end something. I had three endings in mind, this or that, or the other person could die or gone forever. And they all meant something different. They all worked, but the core theme of the story had to change. I'm really bad at committing to things. I've always been afraid of commitment. When I was going to get married, even though I said earlier it was the love of my life, I stress ate. I gained 10 pounds for my wedding because I was so nervous that it might be the wrong commitment or whatever. Basically, I have a hard time committing to things. So any of these endings would work as long as the story was slightly different. And so picking a different path didn't violate the artistic integrity for me. I have to ask her this, but I'm guessing that she probably knew that. I feel like she's the kind of person that wouldn't ask me to do something that was against the story.
Yeah, she would have thought it out thoroughly for sure.
Right. And I think that she just rightfully said there's another ending that you could do and that would be just as good or better. And I think it was the right choice. I think the ending is the exact right ending. And it didn't mean that the entire book was the same except for the last 10 pages. It meant that I changed something on chapter, you know, 3, and chapter 10 had to be completely swapped out for a different thing. And it just, then the entire theme of the book took a slightly different route.
So we have Julia Staub Noble, who'd love to know more about what drives you to be open on social media and when it comes especially to speaking out about diversity. And she really admires you for that. Remember the other listener, Tara Turley Creel, that I mentioned earlier? Tara also asked something along the same lines. She asked, do you feel like being an author has given you a platform to speak out for minorities and people of color? And how do you deal with trolls?
Oh gosh, those are such good questions. I'll answer Julia's question first. What drives me is that back before I was on Twitter, back when I was just on Facebook, and before I was an author, I have some conservative friends, especially through my husband who was pre-law. Mm-hmm. He went to Berkeley and he made a whole range of friends, some quite liberal and some quite conservative. There were people that were friends of his, and I would go onto their Facebook walls and I would pick fights with people that would follow them. And I would argue for equal rights and all those things. And it was a smaller pond. I guess I've just always been very contentious. And so when I had the opportunity to get on Twitter and be more public, I tried at first to be more what I would say professional, less outspoken and less shouty, but that really didn't last very long. I don't know if it's just me or just me and a bunch of people that I know, I guess. I can't not say anything. I'm very contentious. I'm bipolar. So I have these ups and downs and I get very frustrated and angry sometimes when I see these injustices. So I can't not do it. I don't want to make it seem like I'm out of control, but I also don't want to make it seem like I'm actively choosing to do all these good things because I'm a great person. I just think that I get mad when I see things that aren't fair and I can't really not say anything about it. As to dealing with trolls, this is another thing that's super unfair. I have a very white name, half of which I stole from my husband, and Heidi, because I'm mixed race. So my mom is white and has that Swedish Nordic side to her. But I don't really get a lot of trolls. You know, you have to focus in on the avatar to kind of tell that I'm not white. I have friends on Twitter that are black and they get trolls crazily, ridiculous what they have to deal with. For me with trolls, I can basically have a lot of the option to ignore them, but I do go and deal with trolls when I see them on other people's walls. I'd like to report them to Twitter so that hopefully Twitter will deal with them so they can stop harassing friends of mine.
That's awesome. I do that too. And I'm just like, whoa, that was just so uncalled for and unacceptable. And I'll just, I'm like, report.
Yeah.
Thank you for answering those, Heidi. I'm sure Tara and Julia are going to be thrilled with that. What are resources and or books that you can recommend for our listeners to check out?
You know, the funny thing is I have a bunch of craft books, but I read them so long ago that I don't remember their names off the top of my head. What I would say is to improve your craft, read widely in the genre that you love. That shouldn't be so hard anyway. Not only widely, make sure you're reading diversely, make sure you're reading marginalized voices in those genres and really seeking them out if you can. The other thing that I really do to improve my craft is listen to people in the community. Again, marginalized people, people of color, people that are lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer in any way. They usually have such great things to say about how to make the community better. If you're looking specifically to query and get representation, how I did it was studying Query Shark. That is such a great blog. It really helps craft your query letter. And what I found for myself was when I was reading the queries there, I'm sure you know what it is, but for those who don't, it's a blog where an agent, Janet Reed, takes potential query letters and critiques them and lets people come back with edited versions and then critiques them again until they get to a point where she, as an agent, would have said, yes, I would ask for pages on this query. And then she sends you out into the world to query with that letter, which is such a great resource. So use that resource and read those letters. What I found for myself was, as I read them, I actually, and was trying to write my own query letter, I realized that my main character didn't have great motivation. It wasn't clear. So I went back to the book and rewrote it based on the query letter that I was writing at the time. And then having rewritten the book, I was then able to write a really good query letter and it got to yes in just the one round.
Wow.
As you read other people's queries and you really try to distill your work down into that one page, you start to realize if there are any lingering flaws, like lack of entire main character's motivation in my case, or maybe something hopefully smaller or non-existent for you. You know, there are great contests too on Twitter. If you are on Twitter, Pitch Wars or...
Brenda Drake's. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a great one, DV Pit, which is for diverse books. And there's, it's, the acronym is WCNV. And it's, that stands for Women of Color and Native Voices. It's for specifically writers who are diverse. And there are great agents that are searching those hashtags all the time. If you can get your pitch down to 140 characters, which I was never able to do. But any of these resources, depending on the way that you want to take the route that is best for you, you will find a way. And it may not be one of the ones that I mentioned, but I'm sure that everyone can find their own path. And these are just some options.
And that wraps up our episode with the awesome Heidi Heilig.
Heidi, thank you so much for being so open and honest in sharing your stories and experiences. I loved talking to you. Storytellers, thank you for listening in and joining us as always. Please say hello to Heidi on Twitter at Heidi Heilig. Heidi recommended really amazing resources for you to check out. Especially if you're working on querying an agent right now, you'll want to head over to our show notes page, and we have all the resources linked up in her show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Heidi Heilig. Don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other writers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we also post sneak peeks of future episodes. So join me over in our new Facebook group at facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. There is a lot of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.